Article 9, Section 3 of the bylaws state that one-third of the total number of members in good standing in attendance at the meeting shall constitute a quorum for a transaction of business. Now, considering the size of the crowd in the room, I declare that we now have a quorum. Nominees must be members who are neither candidates for nor holders of the offices to be filled, which is the entire exec board now. And I will now entertain nominations from the floor. We need three electors. Oh, come on, people.
Or volunteers.
Or volunteers. Yes, Gary.
Martin Silver.
Okay, we have Martin Silver. Oh, I don't. We have a.
Yeah, that's a green one right over the outside.
I'm going to print from now. Yes, Don. Okay, you're nominating yourself? Okay. And Steve?
Paul Dwinell.
What?
Paul Dwinell.
Okay.
That's me.
Oh, okay.
Are you willing?
Yes.
Can you count?
I move nominations be closed.
Second.
Okay.
Vote.
Okay, it's moved and seconded. The nominations be closed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? I should have you raise hands, maybe. All opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. So these are the three counters, tabulators of our votes, and they will be given the ballots by our executive director. Okay, do I hear a, well, wait, we don't need a motion to adjourn. We're not going to adjourn. The meeting is now in recess, and we will reconvene on Friday afternoon, on Saturday afternoon, or whenever they finish counting. I have one other announcement to make. Last year at the conference, the membership voted two honorary lifetime memberships. And one of the gentlemen was not here at that time when the announcement was made. And so I would like to announce that last year, Phil Miller, who was in attendance, and also David Hall, who was not in attendance, were voted honorary lifetime memberships of ARSC. And I would like David to receive the, since he is here now, to receive the recognition of the association.
What was that?
Thank you very much. That's
Good morning. My name is Richard Perry. I'm program chairman for this 21st annual conference of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections, which has the largest pre-registration in the history of the association. And we're a little bit pleased that everyone did not show up this morning because we thought we might have, as they do on the airlines, to offer free membership for a year to those who be bumped for the room. Whether this registration represents the attractiveness of the program or the general raising of consciousness of ARSC members to this conference, or for the general interest and rise interest in recordings as important cultural objects, it's hard to tell. But it is certainly pleasing to all of those who have worked hard to make this conference come to be. I'd like to make a few announcements before we begin the program. There are a number of venues for this conference, as you are aware, and I think I might be able to clarify a bit of that for you. Today's meetings will take place in this room. Tomorrow morning, the session on jazz will take place at the American Museum of that the, what is it called, the American Museum of Natural History or the Museum of American History?
Museum of American History.
Thank you. It's on 14th and Constitution in any case. And the closest metro stop is Federal Triangle. That might be helpful. You also might like to know that right across the street there's a wonderful Vassar book sale going on, which has records for sale in it as well. Friday afternoon and all day Saturday, the meeting will be the Continental Room, which is downstairs, which is quite a bit larger, and will not strain the air conditioning system, I think, as this room might today. So it's the Continental Room, Friday afternoon and Saturday downstairs. Third floor.
Why don't you mention that if you get off of Federal Triangle, you go across the mall?
Well, you turn toward Constitution.
Across the mall.
Tonight, as it indicates in the program, there's a tour of the Broadcast Pioneers Library, and there are a number of things planned for Friday that are not on the program, Friday evening, that is. There will be a record swap. Do you have the room for that yet?
501.
In 501, room 501, upstairs, past the bowling alley, there will be a record swap. And for those who do not want to attend the record swap and who might be interested, Michael Gray has a showing of videos of great conductors.
And Spike Jones.
He was a great conductor.
And do you have a room for that yet?
Not yet.
That will be announced. I think that should be a great interest. Toscanini, who else do you have?
Nickish, Fritbangler, Knoppers Bush, Beecham, Murphy.
Oh, this is Friday night?
Friday night.
What time?
For those of you of my generation who never saw these men conduct, I think it should be quite thrilling. That will be announced. It hasn't been established yet. And Fred Williams also called to tell me that he will be doing one of his extravaganzas in some room yet to be assigned either, and I will announce that tomorrow. A few other announcements. Tim Brooks would like me to mention that the membership directory, which has names, addresses, phone numbers, areas of expertise, collection, whether it's accessible to members of the association, etc., will be published within the next month, and you all will receive that. Secondly, if you want to check the register to make sure that you are on it and that the information on the computer listing is correct, please see Tim Brooks. Tim, could you rise, please, for those who don't know you? Thank you. And Tim will be carrying around the large directory for the next 3 days and just tap him on the shoulder at any point. Third, if you haven't filled out the questionnaire to be included in this register, you may do so. There are some extra questionnaires on the front table, and Tim also has extras if there are none left. If you want to check the file to find out whether you did send in a questionnaire, that's also at the front desk. Okay? I'd like to make one addition to the program, to this afternoon's session on technology. I'm pleased to announce that Bob Stoddard, the inventor, or Bert Kosar, who represents the company, will be here to talk about and perhaps demonstrate Finial Technologies, a new machine that uses a laser to read vinyl discs. And I think that should be of interest to many of us. That's on the technology session this afternoon. To accommodate the addition of a speaker to the technology session, we would like to start this afternoon's session at 1:15 rather than 1:30. That means a slight run for lunch, but Roy Rogers on Pennsylvania Avenue is quick.
Fate worse than death.
Bill Storm would also like to ask those of you here, Kenneth Whistler, Tom Owen, Fred Granger, John Allen, and the representative from Finial Technology, to meet with him outside in the hall after this morning's sessions. I hope you find the program this year interesting and worthwhile. It seems to me it's a little more balanced than the program I put together for the New York show last year, in that there's a little bit more on jazz and popular music. But there's always a problem, speaking as program chairman, in putting together a program for ARSC, because ARSC embraces so many different aspects of records. Technology, archival, librarian interests, and the various genres of music, spoken word. So it's almost impossible to plan a program to embrace all of these different areas. Last year at the board meeting, I raised the idea that we should have multiple sessions to recognize the fact that ARSC is growing and that the areas of subject and interest are broad within this association. And like other professional associations, we should have multiple sessions. It seems to be a controversial issue. And if you do have an opinion on the subject, I would suggest that you write to whomever is elected second vice president and program chairman for the coming 2 year sessions, if you have any feeling on the subject. We will start then the program.
Not yet.
I want to talk. Oh, I'm sorry. Michael Gray, who's in charge of local arrangements, is going to say a few words. If you have anything nice or critical to say about the program, speak to me. If you have anything nice or critical to say about local arrangements, speak to Michael Gray.
I just have a couple of words. Are there seats in the back? Empty seats in the back?
Yeah.
Marvelous. I lost a couple of nights' sleep worrying about that. just a couple of items. First of all, this will certainly be a memorable meeting in terms of accommodations. could only go by our experience in San Francisco and Syracuse as a guide to what we could expect here. Obviously, Washington being the place that it is, we had a small surprise. Nonetheless, I hope they're acceptable. Secondly, and probably more importantly for those of us who have money to spend, I'm happy to announce that Tower Records, our neighbor across the street, has given us the media discount for all ARSC members. That's around 10%. We present ourselves and our money or our traveler's checks or our plastic money to a manager and say, we are from ARSC, we'd like the media discount.
Right, you can't move.
Probably not. Nonetheless, I was hoping to warn everyone at the beginning of the reception that this would be the case. However, I knew people couldn't wait, as I already see some yellow bags in the back. Suffice it to say that that in the next few days, you'll be able to take advantage of that opportunity. It's my fervent hope that the meetings have been well planned insofar as local arrangements are concerned. Certainly, the program has been well planned. And it was that we go through our meeting, we will have the most successful one we've ever had in the association. take off your jackets, if you have jackets. Relax, have some donuts and coffee or orange juice, and it's going to be a good meeting. Thank you.
I'd like to make one other announcement. I'd like to thank Douglas Graham, the executive producer for Time Life Music, for helping sponsor this morning's program, Coffee and Donuts. And there was also some 30 tapes rocking from the new Rock and Roll series, which probably have been snatched up already. They were complimentary. Mr. Graham, are you still here? Yes, Mr. Graham's in the back. And if anyone wants to speak to him, he'll be here for just a short time this morning. You know, wish to speak to him about anything pertaining to the Time Life program. Thank you. Walter Hahn is requested to call Dorothy Detrick by 10 o'clock. And I have the telephone number here if you want. Thank you. As you may have noticed, there is some logic to the arrangement of the presentations. And the morning session is devoted to archival issues, particularly the use of computers in archives. And the first speaker is Reverend Claude Arnold. Claude Gravely Arnold was born in Detroit in 1929. At the age of 6, he discovered a cabinet Victrola in a friend's attic and thought it the wonder of the age. In the summer of 1945, he heard a record by Paderewski and another by Caruso, experiences which determined him to become a record collector. He completed an MA in philosophy from the University of Western Ontario and then entered a religious community of priest teachers, the Basilian Fathers, and was ordained in 1958. He received a PhD in English from the University of Michigan and has taught at St. Michael's College, University of Toronto, since 1969. Claude Arnold will speak to us on The Orchestra on Record, 1898 to 1925, an encyclopedic discography.
There are a few seats at the front if you're looking for a seat.
There are four.
One here.
Five.
There's two here.
Come over here.
And there's a few more in front. Where are the front seats?
There was a time when clergymen tended to occupy their free moments by editing the texts of the Greek and Latin poets. Now they compile discographies. I suppose that just means the times have changed. How can one give a talk on the orchestra on record, the modern symphony orchestra, that is, limited to the years 1898 to 1925? Everybody knows that nothing of significance was put onto discs or cylinders before electrical recording was introduced. Just some truncated operatic overtures, odd movements from symphonies, bits of salon music. Everybody knows that the acoustical process favored the voice and the violin and brass instruments and distorted everything else. Everybody knows how the great conductors scorned these primitive recordings, their own included. And their modern biographers tell us that they were right in so doing. To talk about the orchestra on record in the pre-electric era, let us leave aside the folly of assembling data for such talk, is simply to waste time. What everybody knows may be true, but it may also be false. And it is to test the truth value of this received wisdom that the project I have to describe to you has been undertaken. What is this project precisely? It involves the compilation of an encyclopedia of recordings of classical and light classical orchestral music, starting with the first Berliner issues in 1898 and concluding with the last acousticals made by the various companies between the spring of 1925 and the autumn of 1926. The primary aim of this encyclopedia is simply to give a systematic account of what was recorded, by whom, and when. The format resembles that of the gramophone shop encyclopedias, a series of composer discographies alphabetically arranged, but adds, wherever possible, matrix numbers and recording dates. The organization of each entry is chronological. The first version, it's really smaller than it looks. This is just quite homemade on typewriter. The first version comprised some 5,500 entries. The version which is now in hand has at least half again as many. I've just used the word discography, but I can't pretend that the work meets the standards of contemporary discography. The project has occupied my free moments over the last 9 years, and with the encouragement of Jerry Weber and Michael Gray, it's taken me from Toronto, where between them, the holdings of the Metropolitan Public Library and the Faculty of Music of the University provide a rich source of materials, to the National Sound Archive in Great Britain, the old British Institute, the Library of Congress here in Washington, and through the Rigler Deutsch Index, the major sound archives of this country. Collectors here in Washington, Stephen Smolian particularly, in Toronto, and in London have been generous in giving me access to their collections. Others have spent months going over the first version of the text produced 4 years ago, adding and correcting errors. The cooperating diligence, that's a phrase of Dr. Johnson's, And you can't talk about a project like this without it quoting the patron saint of harmless drudges. The cooperating diligence of some dozen hands has helped to bring this project to its present state. And yet, too much remains unknown. Enough work has been done to make dating, at least approximate to year and month, possible for the English issues of the Gramophone Company and the English and English Columbia. Just a detail. This is very largely a European project. Not very much was done in America. There just wasn't a market for it. The real work was going on in Europe. With somewhat less completeness, one can date American Columbia. And after 1907, one can date Victor only spottily. I can only express gratitude for the Victor Encyclopedia Project and the work of Frank Andrews and Ronald Taylor on English Columbia, as well as that of the discographers to whom I shall shortly allude. But the Lindstrom Companies, Odeon and Parlophone primarily, continental issues of the Gramophone Company, and all of the smaller producers remain closed books. One is lucky to be able to gather issue dates from trade journals. On the other hand, much is known. I began this enterprise, as one might expect a musical amateur to do, whose tastes were formed 40 or 50 years ago, largely through radio broadcasts, and whose teenage collecting began modestly in the salons of the Salvation Army. Conductors drew my attention, and I was glad to find that data assembled from catalogues and collections could be supplemented and interpreted with the help of a number of excellent conductor discographies. Beecham, Bolt, Albert Coates, Elgar, Klemperer, Mengelberg, Muck, Stokowski, Richard Strauss, Toscanini, Weingartner, they've all been admirably studied. But all of these made electrical recordings on which their reputations now rest. Only one important name who conducted for the horn but not for the microphone, Eugénie Sai, has received a comparably exacting scrutiny. Then I began to assess the character of the material I was actually finding. Many recordings, notably those made before the Great War, were not credited to identifiable orchestras which gave public concerts and therefore had some sort of public history. Of these, a disturbingly large number bore either no conductor's name at all or one which was unfamiliar. I knew who Joe Batten was. He wrote a book. But who was Julian Jones? Victor Opferman? Lillian Bryant? Lillian Bryant is a woman for our age, as far as I know, the first conductor to hold the position of house pianist and house conductor for the British Pathé Company. She should be studied, but she hasn't been. Who were Stanley Chappell, Hein Greenbaum, Cuthbert Whitmore? For that matter, who were Charles A. Prince and Walter B. Rogers? S.L. Wertheim made records with the Queen's Hall Orchestra 6 years before Sir Henry Wood consented to do so. Camillo Hildebrand made 10 times as many records with the Berlin Philharmonic as Arthur Niekisch. Raffaele Breccali recorded as frequently with the orchestra of La Scala for Phonotypia as Carlo Sabino did with the same orchestra for the Gramophone Company. Sabino was evidently a figure of consequence, but who knew anything about him beyond the date of his death? And what about Philippe Flon? One discovered that when he was born, and that the New York's critics liked his performances when he conducted the French repertory at the Metropolitan just after the turn of the century. But hardly a word beyond that. Clearly, the musical world into which I was stepping was characterized by a kind of democratic egalitarianism bordering on anonymity, which sorted ill with aristocratic presuppositions. Justice could be done to the period only by shifting emphasis from musicians as personalities to the works which they performed. The discography of conductors had to become a discography of composers, or more properly, a discography of the orchestra. Far from solving all problems, that decision only gave rise to new ones. Chiefly, what are we going to say an orchestra is? I knew what an orchestra was, a band composed primarily of strings, with a healthy complement of woodwinds and brass as required, and I assumed that whatever the technical difficulties, any attempt to record an orchestra would make at least a gesture in the direction of strings. I just used the word difficulties. The horn, or horns of various aperture, depending upon the recording to be done, was set up at one side of the room, would face a chaired floor area, beyond which was a tiered structure and stools of varying height to accommodate musicians at various levels. Well elevated to one side and behind the recording horns, the podium of the conductor. Also in this layout could be found a number of mirrors whose function will be explained later. Since the distal diameter of the horns was limited, a wide arc of players was impossible. So there was inevitable crowding together towards the center of the horn face. Those instruments of more powerful projection tended to be placed, with certain exceptions, elevated to the rear, but often this would present a problem for certain of them when a solo passage was reached in the work. It was not uncommon, as was the case also with solo passages in choral recordings, to see the cramped ranks open to let pass a colleague clutching, say, a clarinet to reach, hopefully silently, the front of the horn in time for his solo passage, and then retire equally unobtrusively once it was passed. The woodwinds, particularly the oboes, would be pressed up behind the strings seated immediately before the recording horn, while the bass sounding instruments would often be placed, would often be beneath these horns and facing the strings. Here comes into play one set of the mirrors. Since this was the only way, this was the only means of their seeing the conductor placed high above and behind them. Similarly, the orchestral horns were elevated further back with the rest of the brass, perhaps 5 or 6 feet above the rest of the players. But since their bells point behind them, they had to face away from the recording horns so that their bells were directed at those horns. Here came into operation another set of mirrors so that they too could see the conductor, were that thought necessary. Thomas Edison may have invented the phonograph, but it was Rube Goldberg who worked out the details of adapting it to record the orchestra. That, by the way, is from a very interesting symposium given at the Royal Scottish Museum in 1977 in connection with an exhibition called Phonographs and Gramophones. They have it in the Library of Congress library, and it's well worth looking at. Well, anyway, most of the recordings I was interested in, which I'd been able to hear, did make some sort of gesture in the direction of strings, but not all did so. Gradually became clear that in the musical lexicon of the early part of this century, the term orchestra could be used with perfect propriety of a harmony, that is to say, a wind band, and that this was done frequently, sometimes systematically. For example, most Baker, a very large proportion of Pathé orchestrals are in fact band records or harmony records. The American Columbia Company used orchestra to designate both a band with strings and one with winds alone. Sometimes the English Columbia issue of the same recording will clarify matters, but not always. The compilers of the Victor Record Encyclopedia inform us that the Victor ledgers used the word band, at least in the period up to 1907, to designate both harmony and, in the sense of the term that I've used, properly orchestral recordings. The labels of issued performances do distinguish band from orchestra, however, and generally with precision. Well, the received wisdom in these matters would tell us that the problem was simply one of technology. Strings did not record clearly, and so at every opportunity, winds were substituted to do duty for instruments which the acoustical method could not hear very well. In this there is some truth, but not the whole truth. A comment from the Sound Wave for February 1909 deserves most careful consideration. No doubt many talking machine users greatly prefer military bands owing to their volume. Evidently they were teenagers in 1909. But genuine music lovers would rather hear their favorite pieces played by a string orchestra as originally scored. There's another comparative review of the recordings of Tannhäuser. Comparative reviews are very rare in this period. One was given of the Tannhäuser Overture in the Talking Machine News in August 1911. If the reader wants the overture rendered in a soft and soothing way, he will be delighted with the gramophone His Master's Voice discs 050540 and 050541, played in a fascinating style by La Scala Symphony Orchestra, directed under the baton of Carlos Sabino. Yet perhaps your drawing room or salon, where you present your opera, is bigger than ours. You want to entertain a larger audience than we. Well, what better then could than gramophone record 022, played by the Coldstream Guards Band? There's a note in the Phono Trader for January 1912. The Edison Bell Company are issuing the Bijou Orchestra records as an experiment, their object being to discover whether a very quiet, dainty orchestral record will meet with general appreciation from the owners of gramophones. There was a market for band records, both because of their comparatively greater volume and because even in Europe, ordinary people were far more likely to hear orchestral music played in public by wind bands than by symphony orchestras. It seems clear on the evidence, not only of commercially issued recordings, but even of the Mapleson Cylinders. And happily, we can now hear orchestral recordings from that irreplaceable series, in addition to the vocal fragments with which we've become familiar. It's clear, then, that the phonograph, as early as 1901 or 1902, could have done far more than it was ever asked to do in recording orchestral music. If more was not demanded, it was perhaps because there seemed to be no reason why the demand should be made. The realization described here made me value strings wherever they were to be found recorded. And this, in turn, made me increasingly sympathetic to light orchestral recordings. I had not intended to include the likes of Marek Weber and Bela Dios. I suppose we should be patriotic and say Dios Bela. That's what he always did. But as I heard and learnt more, all that had to change. After living in an empty waste surrounded by death, even water snakes look good to the ancient mariner. What all this means is that seeing a catalogue entry for an orchestral performance is not sufficient. At least for the period leading up to 1909-1910 or so, the record has to be heard. I've heard many of the records that I've chosen to list, but by no means all. There are probably more purely band performances included than is desirable, but this merely leaves a refinement for the future to introduce. The period from 1909 to 1911 was, in a modest way, apical. For these were the years which saw recording companies become gradually more and more willing to engage professional orchestras rather than just bands of casually assembled individual players to enrich their catalogs. In 1903, Victor had experimented with Victor Herbert's orchestra, then newly formed substantially from members of the Pittsburgh Symphony who followed their conductor when he left Pennsylvania for New York. In the same year, Columbia announced a series of orchestral recordings to be conducted by Walter Damrosch, of which only one was issued. The Gramophone Company began to use members of La Scala Orchestra in 1905. By 1907 or so, there seemed to have been about 35 players, if we can judge from the publicity photographs made. About 1907, the Pathé Frères in Paris recorded the Cologne Orchestra. The Cologne and La Scala recordings sound surprisingly full and on gramophone, and they may have shown what was possible. In any event, Baker announced a series by members of the Queen's Hall Orchestra, and in the spring of 1909, Herbert's orchestra, with the great man himself, was engaged by Edison's National Phonograph Company. At almost the same time, Landon Ronald brought the new symphony orchestra, of which he'd just become conductor, replacing Beecham, to the Gramophone Company. Only a few months later, the Anchor Company in Germany issued the first recordings made by the newly formed Blüthner Orchestra of Berlin, under their conductor, Bruno Weyersberg. Columbia had evidently been experimenting with Prince's Orchestra, their house band, just as Victor was doing with the Concert Orchestra, which they'd founded in 1907 drawing players from the Metropolitan Opera and the New York Philharmonic Orchestras. These experiments bore fruit in 1911 when Columbia secured Modeste Altschuler's Russian Symphony Orchestra and Victor made Herbert an offer which he chose not to refuse. All of these were real orchestras, a fact which their recordings attest to, and with real orchestras came real conductors. Who were some of the conductors? We know made records because their sponsoring companies thought it worthwhile to publicize their names. A few have been mentioned. Some are still familiar. Ansermé, Beecham, Bolt, Eugene Goossens, Klemperer, Knappertsbusch, Stokowski, Zell, Toscanini, Bruno Walter. A generation ago, still familiar would have applied to a longer list. Leo Blake, Arthur Bodensky, Fritz Busch, Albert Coates, Walter Damrosch, Oscar Fried, Rudolf Gentz, Hamilton Harty, Alfred Hertz, Eric Kleiber, Gino Marinuzzi, Willem Mengelburn, Karl Muck, Arthur Nikisch. Remember, his Beethoven's Fifth was only withdrawn in 1945. Landon Ronald, Frederick Stock, Siegfried Wagner, Henry Wood. There were others, major figures in their day. Camille Cheviot, Nikisch's contemporary, who succeeded his father-in-law, Charles Lamoureux, as conductor of the Lamoureux Orchestra. Edward Cologne. Edward Mérica, who with the youthful Frieder Weissmann was the mainstay of the Parlophone catalog. René Baton, François Ruhlmann, Nikolai Sokolov, who with Henri Verbruggen brought light orchestral music into the towns and villages of the American Middle West. Joseph Stransky and Francis Touche, both historically important, like Stokowski and Henry Wood, for their championing of new music. Eugène Ysaÿe, who made almost as many records as a conductor as he did as a violinist. Another composers on record. Richard Strauss and Elgar, I suppose, are the most familiar, but there were others. Arthur Bliss, Frank Bridge, Eric Coates, Frederick Cowan, Edward German, Victor Herbert. Was he the best Irish conductor before Hamilton Harty, or the best American conductor before Leonard Bernstein? Gustav Holst, Franz Lehár, Alexander Mackenzie, Hans Pfitzner, Emil von Resnicek, Max von Schillings was an excellent conductor. Like Pfitzner and Weingartner made far fewer records of his own works than he did of those of other composers. Franz Schrecker, Ethel Smyth, Johann Strauss III, taking proprietary charge of his family's compositions in addition to his own. Rafe von Williams, Villiers Stanford, Emil Waldteufel. One of the four double-sided records which Waldteufel made for the Gramophone Company in Paris in 1907 was offered for sale last year in England at £300. And I didn't get it. There were others still, important 70 or 80 years ago, now unremembered. Hermann Finck, who spent his life trying to improve the taste of theater audiences in London, improved it by leaving us first recordings of the Nutcracker Suite, Mendelssohn's Music for a Midsummer Night's Dream, and Danse Sacrée et Danse Profane of Debussy. They didn't know that lasted in the catalog from 1911 till 1917, and nobody knew what to make of it. Louis Gann and Carl Komzak leading their own elegant dance music. Francis Poppy, we remember him as composer of the Sphinx Waltz, but he also recorded the first orchestral performance of the Prelude to Parsifal in 1906. Percy Fletcher and Alec MacLean, the precursors and masters of Eric Coates, and a whole raft of popular musicians who documented the musical culture of their age. In this galaxy of names, who were the stars of first magnitude? Which conductors made the most substantial contributions to the recording of the orchestral repertory? And of course, again, we have the traditional wisdom. There weren't any such contributions. We have to make a distinction. Beginnings had to be made somewhere. When Leopold Jacobs led the orchestra which played at London's Trocadero Grill in a performance of the Prelude to Act III of Lohengrin on January the 7th, 1899, that was a beginning. When Nahum Franco, who was concertmaster of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra from 1883 to 1907, led the Metropolitan Opera House String Orchestra in The Hunting Horns from Tannhäuser. I owe this to Stephen Smolian. That was the beginning. So was Walter Damrosch's orchestra playing the Allegro Giocoso section of the Prelude to Carmen in 1903. Sabino's two-sided recording of Strauss's Don Juan in 1908. Landon Ronald's with Herr Wilhelm Bacchus as soloist, playing fragments from the first and third movements of the Grieg Piano Concerto in 1909. His version of the fantasy overture Romeo and Juliet, also two-sided, issued only in Germany in 1913. Kreisler and Zimbalist playing the Bach Double Concerto, 1915. And Sammons with Henry Wood and the Queen's Hall Orchestra playing the Elgar Concerto on four whole sides in 1916. These were all beginnings. Each of these recordings can be said to exceed the norm of its period, but each is abridged. I suppose only one of them, the Kreisler and Zimbalist Bach, seems worth hearing today. It's been reissued on LP at least three times and is still available. But all of these do indicate how musicians, technicians, and entrepreneurs were testing the waters to discover what orchestral music could be entrusted to the talking machine and what the record-buying public would pay money to hear. The chronology suggested here is deceptive. One 7-inch side in 1899, four 12-inch sides in 1916. We ought to be ready for 10 whole sides devoted to one work by 1925. And well, Danton Ronald's Tchaikovsky Fourth and Tchaikovsky's New World Symphony in 1925, electrical. Isn't traditional wisdom proved right? It really worked out quite differently, and of course began with vocal recordings. From 1906 on, a number of companies, gramophone and typewriter primarily, began to issue more or less complete recordings of large-scale works. The Messiah, Mendelssohn's Elijah, Lehár's Merry Widow, Strauss's Die Fledermaus, Giancavallo's Pagliacci, a number of recordings of Gilbert and Sullivan, The Omen of the Guard, Mikado, each had two, Carmen and Faust, Pinafore, Cavalleria Rusticana, a second Pagliacci, this time sung in German, Act Two of Tannhäuser. All of these have been issued between 1906 and 1909, and all are substantially complete. The Pathé series of 1912 added second recordings of Carmen and Faust, and first recordings of Donizetti, La Favorite, Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, and Verdi's Rigoletto, Traviata, and Trovatore. The gramophone company in France had published a complete recording of Beethoven's Serenade, Opus 25, in 1907, this on 9 10-inch sides. The Odeon sets of the Nutcracker Suite and the Midsummer Night's Dream music have already been mentioned. Perhaps, then, it is not too surprising to find a review in Die Phonographische Zeitschrift for November the 23rd, 1911, of a complete recording of a symphony. That war horse of war horses, Beethoven's Fifth. The conductor of the Grosses Odeon Streichorchester is not named. Might have been Frederick Kark, who was Odeon's house conductor for years. Might have been the young Edward Kennecke, who 2 years before had conducted the Tannhäuser recording. Nevertheless, the set provoked from the reviewer Max Chopp the exclamation, "Bravo! Bravissimo! Vivat sequenz!" What the sequence, what followed, was the Pastoral Symphony of Beethoven, Haydn's Surprise, Mozart's 39th and 40th, all of these played by the anonymously led Odeon String Orchestra, all uncut and all issued by 1913. Remember, Niekisch's recording of the Fifth, which is normally assumed to be the first recording of that work, was made in November 1913. The whole work was issued as a set on four double-sided discs in Germany in February 1914. In the United Kingdom, the set came out piecemeal, as the custom was, a movement at a time, the first in May, and the last two in July and August. I beg your pardon, the Andante was issued in January, then the first in May. By that time, war with Germany had broken out, So the second movement was renumbered, credited to the London Symphony Orchestra, and reissued, presumably to appear as part of the series of recordings Nikisch had begun with the London Symphony in June 1913 and completed the following July, in 1914, that is. The reissue was quite rare, I'm happy to say. These were all beginnings, but they were all quite of a quite different sort. And they point a direction which not even the trauma of World War could alter. In Germany and England, and in Russia too, interest appears to have been less marked in France, Italy, and North America. Real enthusiasm was developing for orchestral recordings of symphonic music. The recordings were primitive, but when heard sympathetically, they did, and still can, give pleasure. Perhaps the best way to end is by quoting Arthur Clutton Brock's The Psychology of the Gramophone, one of the most famous pieces that ever appeared in the Gramophone magazine, even got into the Encyclopedia Britannica. I quote selections from it. It must be confessed, this, by the way, came out in volume one of the Gramophone in February 1924. It must be confessed that always with the gramophone we have to make allowances. In a way, the gramophone is a pis-aller, a makeshift, a last resort. But you can train yourself to forget it in happy surroundings without blunting your perception of the music, which is not a pis-aller. It is not or need not be bad art. It is only art obscured by a veil, which may grow thin, so thin that you cease to be aware of it. I know good musicians who cannot endure orchestral recordings of music on the gramophone. There is a veil for them too thick. The quality of sound, they say, is disagreeable. They will not or cannot make the necessary allowances. I must confess that I need the contagion of enthusiasm to make them myself. There are qualities of the orchestra that never survive on the gramophone. The sharpness of attack on the strings, the clearness of their different parts, and the full distinction between strings and woodwind. Pizzicato is usually unpleasant.